Indie Media is DIY news. It is about people reporting their own news directly without the need for reporters, bypassing the corporate media.
There are 100 Indie Media or IMC websites worldwide providing grassroots reports of struggles, campaigns and protests.
There are so many people here who are saying no to the government today, and this is democracy in action.
Everybody's here. Everybody in the country seems to be here. They're just coming from all over the place. The banners are showing all the tiny, tiny little pockets of the country. Everybody has come down here.
The project started 3 years ago covering the massive Seattle protests which shut down the World Trade Organization's summit.
Uncensored and unsponsored, IMC sites can be updated anywhere, anytime, by anyone.
The open to all nature of these sites means that you can publish your own reports about your own issues and at the same time connect to a global network of grassroots news.
What you're about to hear are some of the highlights.
What you are about to hear are some highlights from these global websites and from our very own UK IMC Wire. For more information or to get the news direct from the streets, check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
Waking outside my window. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Drags my senses into the sunlight. For there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now, I have to leave you. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. With my friends now, up to the city. We're gonna shake the gates off.
Hi and welcome to the show. This is Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. It's Wednesday the 25th of February. News just in. Yesterday on Tuesday, the planned eviction of an occupied social centre at 93 Fortess Road in Kentish Town, North London, was stalled by the presence of over 70 supporters. People occupied the rooftops, barricades had been constructed through the night, both inside and outside the building, and supporters were outside the street, outside on the streets, to greet the bailiffs and police who turned up at around 8 o'clock yesterday, although they were only numbering around 8. The bailiffs held a short meeting in a nearby street and then disappeared again. All morning, the people outside the social centre got support from passing cars and passengers on the buses. Lots of flyers were given out explaining the situation and the reasons for why they've opened the social centre. A reporter from the local newspaper also came to cover the events. Earlier in the evening, a police patrol van had pulled up next to the social centre and police chased people as they ran back into the building. At first, the police tried kicking the door in, and when this failed, they resorted to smashing the glass in the windows. When the officers called in the incident, they were told by their headquarters that they already knew about the building and that there was an eviction planned for the following morning and that the 8 officers who were on the scene should leave immediately, which they did. The main demand from the people occupying the social centre is that they be allowed to stay until the 31st of March, finishing their advertised programme of events at the centre, at which point they have said they will leave perfectly peacefully. They also say they want time to hold public meetings with the locals of the area who have been using the building to find another venue to continue the project. Nothing is certain, however. Many people think that an eviction would now require specialist bailiffs to remove people from the roof and cut others out of lock-ons and deal with the extensive barricade defences inside. And there is no sense of complacency, however, at the social centre, and supporters say they are determined to stay en masse to maintain the space. Events coming up at the centre include film nights, a jumble sale, arts workshops and a regular cafe. And this morning we haven't had any updates from them, so we're hoping that they're still there. If you want to find out any more information about this social project, check out indiemedia.org.uk.
We'll be right back. Coming up now on news from one of the anti-Rhodes tree protest camps we reported about last week. Blackwood Tree Camp at St David's Woods in Wales has won a temporary reprieve in court, a week's adjournment of the possession and eviction proceedings. Campaigners are battling against the first use of a new type of injunction and are desperate for legal expertise and advice. Work on destroying the trees is being stopped daily, if sporadically, by camp dwellers, local children and visitors. Although the company Costain are crashing on and cutting down trees on other parts of the route, one recent report details how, after local pressure, the police turned out to photograph workers destroying a protected bat habitat. Evidence which campaigners hope will help them demonstrate what they say is the illegal activity of Costain. On Monday, March the 1st, the campaigners will be holding a rally in the woods they are trying to save. For more information, see www.roadalert.org.uk.
Last Thursday, the High Court gave a landmark ruling that the police had unlawfully breached the human rights of anti-war protesters who were detained and prevented from attending a protest at RAF Fairford last March. The court, considering in a judicial review, firmly ruled the detention and forced return to London could not be justified, and that the right not to be arbitrarily detained, Article 5 of the Human Rights Convention, had been breached by the police. The protesters are now expected to pursue compensation from the police later in the year. The case involved police forces from Gloucestershire, Thames Valley, the Metropolitan Police, West Mercia, Northamptonshire, Avon and Somerset forces and Devon and Cornwall. Last month, the judicial review hearing saw police statements revealing that on the day in question, an order was issued by Chief Superintendent Lambert to stop and search the three coaches, including instructions for the coaches to be turned around and escorted non-stop back to London if any dangerous items, or items likely to be used to conceal identity, were found. Michael Fordham, acting on behalf of the protesters, had said that the police were within their powers to seize certain items, and that they even possibly had the right to detain certain individuals under public order and common laws. But the police overstepped the law and infringed both common law and human rights law by the blanket nature of their action, despite Joint Intelligence Committee intelligence notes showing that the police were aware that the coach passengers were made up of individuals and members of various different groups.
Giving judgment, Lord Justice May commented, "For practical purposes, none of the articles seized were to be regarded as offensive. Two pairs of scissors would not make much of an impression on the fences of the airbase." However, the court went on to rule that the police were acting lawfully in turning protesters away from the demonstration, a conclusion Mr. Halford, solicitor from Bynemans and Partners, described as inconsistent and unsatisfactory. "The people from the coach look like they will appeal. The police have also been given leave to appeal. Tomorrow, Thursday the 26th, there will be an event about the case with two short films about the incident being screened and speakers from Liberty, Amnesty and State Watch. It's at 7 p.m. at the School of Oriental and African Studies, or SOAS, Thornhill Street, Russell Square, London." And now we have some audio from Jane Lepore, who took the ruling against the police.
"Just ruled that the police were unlawfully detaining on the coaches, that constitutes arbitrary detention under the Human Rights Act, the way it interacts with common law powers of the police here in this country. So we're very, very pleased. But we're concerned that the judges ruled that the police were right in turning away from the protest. So we've been denied our right to protest, denied the right for lawful assembly, and we'll be seeking leave to appeal. But we're extremely pleased, we're extremely happy. This will have implications for the Mets case against May Day protesters, not to the circus, and we're absolutely pleased."
What message do you think the cause is sending out to the police?
They're saying that the police have to be very careful how they interpret the law, and I think the fact that we've got leave to appeal to go to court appeal means that we're going to look further into how police can deny the right protesters to demonstrate.
Jane, what's the fundamental principle here? What's going to change? What, if anything, could change in terms of the right to protest?
Well, the thing is the court has said that we were unlawfully detained, but there's no point having freedom of movement if you can't have freedom of expression. So that's why we're continuing with the appeal. but the point is that we were denied the right to protest against a war that we all think was completely unjustified. And regardless of whether we protest against the war, whatever we want to protest about, we should be allowed to in a democracy.
What do you think the police should do now when they're faced with big demonstrations?
They have two obligations on a demonstration. One is to maintain a breach of the peace, but the other is to facilitate lawful protest. I think they need to think carefully about what it is that they set out to do when they police a demonstration. If you saw this morning, we had police standing in front of our banners saying that they wouldn't move away from our banners. So nobody could see what we were protesting about. And that's just a small example of the kind of thing they do when faced with protesters.
How big a sort of day is this for you and your protest?
It's a huge day, not just for us, but for all protesters. And anyone that feels that democracy is important right in free society.
How would you describe the police behaviour that day?
Completely overstepped the mark. My feelings of the day was it was just completely surreal, being surrounded by motorcycle outriders and Land Rovers and police filming us constantly while we're on the coaches. I couldn't believe it was happening in this country. I mean, this is why we're supposed to be going to war with Iraq, because people are being denied their freedom of speech, and it was happening to us. But it's been worth it. But we'll get another victory, we hope.
Young Christians knelt and prayed in a 50-foot-long makeshift trench outside the Defence Export Services Organisation, DESO, in Bury Place, central London. They were calling for an end to the public funding of DESO, the controversial government department which markets UK arms exports on behalf of companies, and for the millions of pounds currently being spent on this promotion of weapons to be put to better use. DESO is also behind the Dicey Arms Fair, Europe's largest arms fair, which was held over September the 11th last year. The protesters marched from Bloomsbury Central Baptist Church in a slow procession to the sound of a mournful drumbeat. Holding daffodils as symbols of hope and new life, the protesters knelt to take communion in the massive makeshift war trench outside the DESO offices. street theatre was performed, highlighting the arms trade in death. This action coincided with the tabling of two early day motions by Labour MP John Battle supporting the anti-arms trade campaign. Becky de Cunha, campaigns coordinator at Speak, the Christian group which organised the protest, said UK arms exports are causing countless deaths and fuelling conflicts all over the world. Not only is our government allowing the sale of UK arms to dangerous and oppressive regimes, it is actually subsidising the arms companies to sell them. DESO is spending over £60 million per year of taxpayers' money to aggressively market arms to countries like India and Pakistan. This subsidy is immoral and uneconomical and could be spent creating far more jobs that benefit societies rather than destroy them. Another campaigner, Lucy Cathcart, said DESO is shrouded in secrecy. Most people don't even know their taxes are being spent in this way. I'm joining in this action because I hope it will expose the myths that are surrounding the arms trade.
During the war on Iraq, the B-52 bombers flying from Fairford flew 122 combat sorties, a total of 1,600 flying hours in 33 days, and, according to an American military magazine, dropped £3.2 million of bombs. The US Air Force has also apparently admitted that they did not have sufficient firefighters at RAF Fairford during the last year, an issue they are now addressing through the creation of a new airbase group. The secretary of Swindon Stop the War Coalition, Andy Newham, commented, "I think that many people will be alarmed to learn that the US Air Force did not have enough firefighters while they were flying 1,600 tons of high explosives out of Fairford." Or million tons, that should be. "The safety of Swindon was never considered during the war. All of these high explosives were transported through our streets by lorry during the war. What would have happened if Iraqi soldiers or others had attacked these convoys, something they were legally entitled to do during a war? Has Tony Blair prepared an answer for Swindon? Were they prepared for Swindon to be collateral damage?" The Swindon Stop the War Coalition also opposes the refuelling tankers which are now to be moved to Fairford. The US Air Force is spending £15 million expanding their Mildenhall airbase. "They would only be doing that if they are planning more and bigger wars in the future," says the Stop the War Coalition spokesperson. Figures also indicate that during the anti-war protests at Fairford, the police used stop and search powers under the Terrorism Act to carry out well over 2,000 searches against protesters in a period of just 52 days. Listeners may remember that a legal challenge over the use of the Anti-Terrorism Act against protesters during the anti-Dicey arms fair protests last September in London failed. But with figures like this, one wonders just how the authorities can deny that the anti-terrorism powers were being used extensively against protesters.
Three women were arrested in Haringey last October for putting up posters advertising a community book fair. The women were arrested for criminal damage by two vanloads of police after putting an A4-size poster onto a giant billboard. The most illegal thing about the whole situation, however, seems to be the billboard itself, as no planning permission was given out for it or for 48 out of the other 50 billboards along the same road. The companies involved have had no legal action taken against them at all for erecting the massive, unsightly and illegal posters, which we sure don't advertise anything quite as nice as community book fairs.
In Germany, the protests against nuclear transports around Dannenberg and Gorleben have been legendary since the convoys began in 1995, with tens of thousands of protesters trying to prevent them moving. German authorities have regularly deployed up to 15,000 police to thwart the protesters' plans. The resistance against the transport of the convoys have seen mass road blockades, with tractors being chained together, hundreds of people locking themselves to train tracks, as well as the physical destruction of the train tracks themselves. Meanwhile, it's been widely reported recently that ministers here are preparing a policy which could turn Britain into, quote, the nuclear dustbin of the world, by allowing thousands of tons of radioactive waste shipped to the UK from abroad to be stored here permanently at Sellafield in Cumbria, rather than returning to the fuel's country of origin. British Nuclear Fuels, which operates Sellafield, has faced massive financial problems in the past in making the facility pay for itself and has been bailed out by the government many times, as well as being slammed many times over safety concerns and pollution. An initial estimate by the Department of Trade and Industry has said the Sellafield operator, British Nuclear Fuels Limited, could raise around £500 million from this new policy. Meanwhile, Irish MEP Nuala Ahem called for a team of international experts to investigate possible contamination at the Sellafield nuclear plant, while the Irish Labour Party spokesperson on nuclear safety, Deputy Stagg, has called on the Irish government to seek an immediate meeting with their British counterparts on the future of the nuclear reprocessing plant. Deputy Stagg's call comes after revelations that the Radiological Protection Institute of Ireland is finding it increasingly difficult to access information about the plant from the British authorities.
It is a murderation, this is a tiller's production, and satisfaction is guaranteed as I will tell you, tell you, tell you, tell you.
Journalists of Italian state TV have been threatening to resign over censorship and disinformation. The situation around censorship has now become so unbearable that the news journalists of Rai, state television, have threatened to resign collectively. The president of Rai has declared that public TV has become the graveyard of professionalism. This statement followed the veto by Berlusconi of a prime-time news programme which would have shown different points of view.
Shock horror.
Yeah. Rai Free, the channel which shows more diverse news, has become the target of budget cuts and surprise inspections. The director of Rai Free is being punished because he has allowed an interview with the director of The Economist, which showed the shortcomings of Berlusconi. Rai One, the main Italian news, have been censoring declarations by the Italian president, by the president of the European Commission, and by practically anyone who states that the present government is nothing but successful. When statements by the opposition are shown, they are cut so that they appear incomprehensible. To understand better what is going on in Italy, we must remember that Berlusconi, spiritual advisor Father Gianni Baguette Bozzo, declared last week that Berlusconi has been inspired by the Holy Ghost to fight the communists. Commenting a speech by Berlusconi, he then added, "This speech proves the great wisdom of our commander. He is our absolute leader." Blah.
Last week, after a long day of hearings, activists opposed to the triple border fence planned for the US-Mexico border applauded as the Coastal Commission in America rejected the border fence as it is currently proposed. A statement from one of the groups campaigning against the border fence said, "We believe that people who wish to enter this country through legal or extra-legal means are still human and deserve the same human rights as anyone else in this country. They do not deserve to be shot at, hunted down, driven into the desert, or harassed and intimidated by military border patrol agents."
Hooray!
The triple border fence embodies the most racist and violent face of so-called free trade, which allows capital to flow freely across borders, but not people who create the capital. In addition, it embodies the full spirit of militarism for the sake of economic gain. And I'm sure that's something that's finding resonance with people, with all the media stories about the EU enlargement and work permits currently going on in the mainstream media.
Stop the Australia-US Free Trade Agreement. On Sunday, the 8th of February, President George Bush and John Howard, Bush's Australian deputy, agreed over the phone to sign a free trade agreement between Australia and the USA. How cosy. In reality, many of the USA agricultural barriers remain in place. Sugar, or contain escape clauses, beef, while Australian investment barriers have lifted. The powerful US pharmaceutical industry, major supporters of George Bush, were able to get toehold in changes to the Australian Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme, PBS, which provides prescription medication at reasonable prices to consumers. Under the agreement, Australia will adopt US-style copyright laws similar to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Electronic Frontiers Australia have attacked the intellectual property clauses in the agreement. Meanwhile, Australia's cultural industries to lose out to the dominance of the US film and television industry, which is a big shame. Rabbit Proof Fence is a great film. Some say this is not so much a trade agreement, but an investment. Sorry, but an investment agreement with the sting in little-known investor state provisions that will allow US... Sorry, can you take that, Dave?
Where are we up to? Rabbit Fence, very good film indeed. Some say that this is not so much a trade agreement, but an investment agreement with the sting in a little-known investor state provision that will allow US corporations to challenge any local, state or federal laws that forbid them from entering a foreign country. While George Bush needs congressional approval on the text, the Australian President John Howard does not require approval of the Australian Parliament. Back in Australia, the Greens have called for a Senate veto on the issue, and the Labour Party in opposition has pledged a thorough review of the agreement. Activists in organisations like Friends of the Earth and Global Trade Watch are now mobilising to try and defeat the agreement, along with a broad alliance of over 70 organisations in the Australian Fair Trade and Investment Network. This is an issue we'll be hearing quite a bit more about in the coming months. Check out any of the Australian indie media websites for more news on this.
and you're listening to Resonance FM on 104.4, and I just would like to apologise for my outburst of giggling just then. It's been a long day.
In the northern province of Santiago de Estero in Argentina, the local government has recently banned all types of public meetings that do not have prior consent. Anyone not complying is subject to imprisonment of between 1 to 30 days and a fine of between 10 to 20 days' worth of pay. The new law came in response to demonstrations, all of which have been peaceful, and a memorial service to mark the first anniversary of the brutal torturing and murder of two young girls by an ex-policeman. Witnesses in the case have received death threats from the governor of the province. It seems the local authorities and police are closing ranks to suppress protest against violence, corruption and impunity, a return, seemingly, to the bad old days of Argentina. On the flip side, however, on Thursday the 19th of February, there was a day of Picatero protest which saw 107 streets across the country blockaded for more than 17 hours. The underlying causes of the demonstration were new laws made for increasing flexibility at work, or rather cutting the social security benefit system. For more information, check out www.argentina.indymedia.org.
Times of change in Latin America. After the military cycle that killed hundreds of thousands of people and devastated their economies, Latin Americans are gradually recovering from their tragic recent past. Reacting to foreign intrusion and the FTAA, the Free Trade Area Agreement of the Americas, which is viewed as an aggression against their liberty and self-determination, Latin America is moving towards the creation of a single confederation from the Rio Grande to Cape Horn, called Patria Grande, Big Fatherland. The epicenter of this peaceful revolution is Venezuela, where President Hugo Chavez is inspired by the ideas of Simon Bolivar and other revolutionaries such as Zapata, Sandino and Che Guevara. One of his projects is Petro America, a merger of the state-owned Latin American oil companies to compete on equal terms with the giant private corporations. In most Latin American countries, left-wing parties are winning elections. In others, rulers who followed neoliberal policies were deposed by popular uprisings, indigenous movements playing a leading role in them. Latin America's indigenous and African roots are being revalued and are influencing a new generation of artists and writers. Latin American countries are also pursuing a more independent foreign policy. They formed the bulk of the G22 group that successfully resisted the US axis in Cancun. Last week, after being criticized by the US Department of State for his relations with Venezuela and Cuba, Argentinian President Kirchner said that his country is not a doormat of the United States anymore. He is also considering a referendum where people would decide whether they should continue paying the foreign debt. It is estimated that more than 80% of the population should vote no. Latin Americans strongly oppose the invasion of Iraq, and Brazil's Lula has recently visited several African and Arab countries, calling for a Latin American African Arab partnership.
Your monkey has swept me up tight.
Over the past week, paramilitary groups in Haiti have continued to burn buildings and attack police stations, while the opposition continues to refuse negotiations and the call for President Jean-Bertrand Aristide's resignation. Meanwhile, the corporate media have continued to ignore numerous aspects of the situation, including the US financial support for the opposition, previous US involvement in the region, including support of military dictators, the freezing of over $500 million in international aid and loans, and efforts to prevent the raising of the minimum wage. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere and has been used as a source of cheap labour by companies like Disney, Walmart and Kmart, among many others. Workers are paid as little as 11 cents per hour. And the country has a long history of resistance. The year 2004 marks 200 years of independence. In 1971, 400,000 Africans enslaved there rose up against the French colonial rule. Haiti was declared a free nation in 1804, culminating the world's only successful revolution of enslaved people. From the beginning, it found itself isolated and besieged. The United States led a worldwide boycott against it and refused to recognize the new nation until 1864, fearing that its freedom would pose a danger to the U.S. system of slavery. In 1825, the people were forced to assume a debt to France of 90 million gold francs, roughly equivalent to about 21 billion US dollars, as reparations to their former, quote, owners, in return for diplomatic recognition and the right to trade. To make the first payment, Haiti closed all its public schools in what has been called the hemisphere's first case of structural adjustment.
Haiti is an example of the free trade frontline. 80% of the population live in poverty, despite President Aristide's promises of reform. Misery has further increased in 2000 by the decisions of international donors, including the US and the EU, to suspend virtually all aid. By 2003, the suspended aid and loans totaled more than $500 million. In an attempt to turn the economy around, a deal was struck with the US. The World Bank agreed to fund new free trade zones, FTZs, in Haiti. In April 2002, work started on one of Haiti's most fertile agricultural regions, the Marabahou Plain, to build the first free trade zone factory, where Haitian workers are now making Levi's for very low wages. But the plan doesn't stop there. 17 free trade zones are expected to stretch along the entire length of the border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Haiti is on the brink of civil war, and the capital is under threat as the campaign to oust Jean-Bertrand Aristide heightens. This couldn't have come at a more ironic time, as Haiti celebrates the 200th anniversary of its independence, when slave armies rose up against their French colonial masters.
And we're almost out of time. We're going to be playing out with a news item and some audio from The Hague, the International Court in the Netherlands, shortly. Just time to say that coming up on the 2nd of March, Tuesday the 2nd of March, there's a free screening of the film The Fourth World War, which was made by the Big Noise tactical crew. That brings together 2 years of footage from the front lines of struggles in Mexico, Argentina, South Africa, Palestine, Korea, all over the world, in fact. That's being screened by Indie Media Cinema. It's at 7 o'clock on Tuesday, March the 2nd, and that's upstairs at the Brixton Ritzy in Cold Harbour Lane. So check that one out.
Stop the apartheid wall at The Hague. At the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, The Hague, Netherlands, there was a hearing as to the legality of the apartheid wall being erected across Palestine. The wall's construction, which has been criticised by the International Committee of the Red Cross, is widely seen as further land grabbing by the Israeli government, who couch its existence as a necessity for security in protection of the Israeli state. On Monday the 23rd, Zionist groups held a high-profile demonstration in front of the International Court. The local Israeli embassy sponsored students and members of Zionist groups to support the wall, to protest outside the court, and provided full colour pictures of bomb victims to Christians for Israel to carry on street protests. Zaka, an Israeli rescue organisation, brought to The Hague two halves of a Jerusalem No. 19 bus destroyed in a suicide bombing. As the hearings concerning the legality of the wall started in The Hague, thousands of Palestinians and internationals throughout occupied territories took to the streets to protest against the construction of the wall. The proceedings are expected to conclude in about 1 month's time. Now we have some audio recorded at the protests. I apologise, it's quite roughly edited, but it's lots of different viewpoints from both the Israelis, the Palestinians, and people concerned with actual policing of the Palestinian demonstration. So that's all from us. Bye-bye.
Thank you. a single person who can get his collective, you know, anyway. It's just the situation calls for this. If it was different, so, you know.
So you don't think that the wall should be along the 1967 border? It's not a border.
No, it's not a border. It's just a means of secure.
All right. Why couldn't it be secure along the 1967 border? Why couldn't that be a security barrier?
I think a strategic. I don't make the policies. I just go with what I know already. So.
So you think that the wall is? You think that the wall is necessary for the safety and protection of Israel?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Okay. So why are you here today?
I'm from New York.
You are living there?
Yes.
Okay. So, why are you here?
Well, this is a tribunal of anti-Semitism.
Daniel Sheffi.
This is a tribunal of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is when the Jewish people is treated and judged on a different standard. When the whole world has a right to defend itself and Israel does not have a right to defend itself, that is anti-Semitism. This day we live in infamy. We are standing on European soil. 60 years ago, the Jewish people was defenseless and the world was silent as 6 million was murdered. And today, in 2004, Israel has the power to defend itself and the whole world comes together and tells Israel it does not have a right to defend itself.
This is
international anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is when Israel, the Jewish people, is judged differently than other people. Every nation state has the moral responsibility to defend its citizens. Every state can defend its citizens. England can defend its citizens. Germany can defend its citizens. The Netherlands can defend its citizens. The only one that can't is Israel. That's anti-Semitism.
Well, the state of Israel is not here. They didn't come. Why?
Well, they didn't come because this is just an outrage. This is a trial of anti-Semitism. This is a day of infamy. Look how many fences are in front of the Hague. When those fences go down in front of the Hague, those tough iron fences, then Israel will take down its fences. Look at these buses. Look at this bus. Every nation state has the right and responsibility to defend itself. When every nation
can...
Okay, and I'm here specifically because I was speaking to kind of people that support the wall this morning who came from Israel, who explained to me that it's actually legal for people to build walls on occupied territories. I'm not sure if this is true. Could you tell me, is it legal to build the wall on an occupied territory?
I find it very hard to understand how they can claim that. Rulings of the International Criminal Court of Justice just here in 1971 and 1975 state very clearly that an occupying power must, in order to allow the rights of the people to self-determination, must leave the occupying territory immediately. Into their own country in any way, but whether it's temporary or permanent, they're not allowed. Question: people have suggested that it is not illegal to build a wall on the occupied territory, but it is clear from previous rulings of the International Court of Justice that it is. That, in the case of the Western Sahara and Namibia, the court ruled very, very clearly that it is not possible for occupying powers to integrate the occupied territory into their own territory, in their own territory in any way. They must leave the occupied territory immediately. They're not allowed to integrate it. And what's more, is that they cannot claim the right to military protection or self-defence in the occupied territories.
So how are they being allowed to do this?
They're strong, and
the world is not yet prepared to put enough pressure on them.